WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We can all remember presidential elections in which the candidates tried not to talk about the economy because the subject was considered too complex and too dull. But this time around, the economy is the number one issue because so many voters are worried about jobs, health insurance, and just making ends meet. Economist Robert Heilbrunner is enthusiastic about the public interest in the subject, even if he's less than enthusiastic about the state of the economy. Heilbrunner is a professor of economics at the New School for Social Research in New York and the author of several books which have been used as college texts. His latest books are The Debt and the Deficit, and a new edition of his 1974 work, An Inquiry into the Human Prospect. He's, of course, following the candidates' economic proposals. He says although the Democrats are trying to be bold, there's something that's holding all of them back.
They all want to sort of overcome Bush's timidity, and they all want to do something more socially imaginative. They want to do something to directly recognize unemployment as a problem and launch anti-unemployment problems, measures, and so forth. But I think that all of them, even the Democrats, are terribly constrained by a fear. And the fear is something called the deficit. They're all afraid that to do something on a large scale, something more than just lowering interest rates or forgiving people taxes for something for a while, will require the government to borrow money and go out and build major projects. And they're right. I mean, that is, I think, the only way to turn the country around. But when you borrow money, you run up the deficit, and as soon as you say the words deficit, people blanch, faint, I mean, have apoplectic fits, and so you can't do that. So even the Democrats are terribly constrained by this hobgoblin called the deficit.
Now, let's look at the deficit. You said that the deficit is used as an excuse for not investing
in
lots of important things.
Yeah.
What do you think the deficit is holding us back from investments?
Let me start one step back. May I?
Yeah.
What we have to do, and we haven't done, is build up a strong public sector. I mean the roads and the bridges and the harbors and the air transportation and the air radio, what do you call it, guidance system, and the things that government does to provide what I often speak of as the embankment on which the private railroad runs. That embankment has been perilously ignored. In Japan, in France, in Germany, in Austria, and all the countries of Europe, during the years of boom, they built the public embankment. As you know, when you go to France and ride on those fantastic trains, or Japan and other fantastic trains, or Germany and the wonderful road system, or the general level of public support you find everywhere in Europe, you do not find in this country, where you have but to open your eyes in downtown New York or try to get across the Queensboro Bridge or ride the damn train to Washington, and you know that we live in a country which may be very rich, but which is starved in its public facilities.
Now, why is that? Does that have anything to do with the Reagan-Bush philosophy of not having government spend a lot of money and, you know, withdrawing government from a lot of places it had been before?
Yes, I think, look, that's the, I think there's three explanations. The deepest explanation is, I think, some funny American antipathy towards government. In Europe and Japan, people look to government investment with a great deal of pride. Paris, the most beautiful city, all Frenchmen say. I mean, all Germans exult in the wonderful road system and so forth. Americans, for whatever reason, regard the government not as a source of pride. I don't mean what government does. I mean what government builds. Not as a source of pride, but with a shrug of the shoulders or with a general feeling that the less of it that there is, the better. Whatever the government does, the private system could do better. So underneath, there's some deep suspicion about government. On top of that, there is indeed the Reagan-Bush philosophy, which is whatever thing you can eliminate from government, you should, because the economy will run better. So they eliminate it like mad. We spend about one quarter as much as a percentage of GNP on this public capital, this infrastructure, as we did in the 1950s. There never was such a period of running down of public infrastructure as the last roughly 15 years. And that's where the crux lies. And the question is, what to do about it? And because it is public capital, it's not something you can ask General Electric to do. I mean, you don't make money building bridges, and there's no possible way of building a bridge and putting a toll on it big enough to make money. You're not going to build a high-speed train unless you put in a whole new railroad embankment, and not to speak of financing the research and development. It's going to be a public project, though later on it may be put into private hands for running.
Okay, so this takes money. If it's a public project,
yep.
It takes a lot of public money. We don't have it now. I mean, we do have this huge deficit, and we're paying enormous interest on it. So where do you propose getting the money from?
Well, there isn't any place to get it from, really, except borrowing. And the thing that the public has to understand is that there are two kinds of borrowing. Very bad borrowing, which everybody would like to minimize, and good borrowing, which people should applaud. And the way to make people understand those heretical statements is to point to their own lives. You meet a man in a cocktail party, and after a while you say to him, he tells you about his finances. he says to you, "Well, last year, you know, I went $50,000 in debt." $50,000 in debt, you say? What'd you do that for? He says, "Well, I had these losses at the track." You mop your forehead and tell the guy he's headed for real trouble. He answers the same question, $50,000. "Oh, yes, I took a mortgage out on the house." You say, "That's very different. That's good. Good for you. And where to live and so forth." You meet another guy who's a businessman. He tells you that last year he borrowed $100,000 for his business. You look at him saying to yourself, "What did he borrow it for?" He tells you later on, "Well, he can't meet the payroll." You know that man's going to go bankrupt. You get the same man, or a man looks just like him, and he tells you he borrowed $100,000, and what for? "Well, he's putting on this new wing on his shop, or he's buying these new machines for his factory." And you say, you know, this is a guy who may be riding the path for growth and profits.
Aren't we in the position, though, of the guy who says he's borrowing $100,000 for his business to meet payroll, and he's borrowing also another $100,000 to build a new wing?
Now you're talking very good sense, and I think that is in fact what we're doing. We're borrowing partly for capital and partly for payroll, and we ought to be borrowing only for capital, except because it's a government. Sometimes in bad times you borrow just to give the economy a shot in the arm. But essentially what you say is right, and there's one big problem that makes this so difficult for ordinary people to understand. It is that we don't run a budget, I mean really a set of figures, which would enable people to see what we're borrowing for. In the government, you put all the expenditures together, whether they're for capital goods or for interest or whatever, and you tuck it up, you compare it with taxes, and the difference is called the deficit. The borrowing is the deficit, and there's literally no way, unless you're an expert and take the detailed figures of the OMB, Office of Management and Budget, there's no way for an ordinary person to say, "Aha, last year we borrowed $200 billion, and I see from the numbers that we borrowed $175 billion to do all these projects which are spelled out, and $25 billion on top, which we probably shouldn't have." There's no way of doing that. So people take the whole $200 billion, the total $350 billion, and they say, "Oh, my God. The country's run like a madman. Country's going to go bust." Countries don't go bust so easily.
So your point here is that in spite of the fact that we have this huge deficit, we should still be borrowing for things that we'll really need and that will, in the long run, improve the health of the country.
I mean, 100% absolutely. But that is quite impossible to do until people understand what you're doing. And as long as the deficit has this huge number with no explanation attached, I don't blame people the tiniest bit. The feeling that, "Oh, my God, I mean, my national heritage is somehow being squandered."
What do you think the consequences will be if we don't rebuild our bridges and roads and mass transit systems?
The consequences would be that you'll break more axles in your car, blow more tires, take more time getting to Washington. And as a consequence of those personal misadventures, business doesn't run as efficiently. I mean, it takes longer, it costs more, and estimates now are estimates from very sober people that you get twice as much bang for the buck, twice as much growth in real output from a dollar put into public capital as you do from a dollar put into private capital. That's not because a road is in itself more production-generating than a machine. It's just that roads are in such bad shape. Bridges are in such bad shape. The embankment of the economy is in such bad shape. That's where the payoff is. And I forgot to mention, of course, one of the most important things to borrow for, not just the kind of capital you ride on or kick with your foot. It's a kind of capital economists call human capital. It's knowledge. The scores of American students are, as you know, very alarming compared with the scores of foreign students. And there's something about our education system that's lacking. Some of it may be quite beyond anything that money will cure, but some of it is not beyond what money will cure. And we need to borrow in order to increase the stock of knowledge that people have. We need to make loans available to people who can't afford to go to college to go to college. So I'm very much in favor of public borrowing for expansion purposes. That to me is the brightest path available to lead this country back to where it should be.
If you're just joining us, my guest is economist Robert Heilbrunner, and his two latest books are The Debt and the Deficit and a new edition of The Human Prospect. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Economist Robert Heilbrunner is my guest. I have to get your thoughts on the fall of communism. Did you ever think that you would live to see that happen?
Never. Never. What economists do, what this economist does, who's written a number of books that he used in colleges, is look with trepidation on what I said and see what it looks like in the light of realities. And, I wrote, as everybody wrote, about the Soviet Union, using those words, USSR, as a fact of life. I mean, it was as big as Gibraltar, and it would be there for a long time. It was running, the last time I wrote most of my last editions, it was already running very badly. And I had all sorts of projections and guesses about how it would stagger along, whether it would somehow manage to introduce more markets and the rest. But, of course, nobody imagined that it would just plain collapse.
Do you think that socialism ever got a fair shake?
It's very hard to know exactly what socialism is. I used to think I knew. I mean, we thought it meant something called planning and all the nice democratic privileges that we enjoy. Right now, I think that there is something called enlightened capitalism or public interest capitalism, and that we have it in a number of countries. I think of Austria, and I think of the Netherlands, I think of Scandinavia, and sometimes I think of the U.S., and sometimes I don't. And I do believe that capitalism comes in different packages, some very, very good and some not so good.
What's enlightened capitalism?
Well, it certainly has a high level of civil liberties, that I would say. And I think it understands that capitalism is a very complicated system with all the technology that it encourages that requires a delicate balance between what I consider to be the three big players in a modern economy. One of them is labor, one of them is business, and one of them is government. And that until you have some sort of concordat, some sort of tacit or explicit understanding about how those three parties work together, you probably aren't going to be able to use the government in a forceful way to, quote, right wrongs and do good and see that the economy goes in the right direction.
What's one example of an aspect of another country's economy or, you know, the relationship between politics and economic planning that you'd like to borrow for the United States?
Well, yes, I'll tell one in a second. Just to say a word about borrowing, something that works very well for, let's say, Sweden, may not survive the passage across the ocean at all. Ditto Japan, even more so. But I'll tell you something I like that's going on in Germany. I talked about the three players, unions and business and government. Those players have worked out something in Germany that I find very interesting. One of the great challenges that modern capitalism faces in every country is its inflationary tendency. When I was a boy, there was no inflation. I mean, when my grandparents took their hard-earned money and bought bonds, government bonds or railroad bonds that paid 3%, they were very happy to get the 3% and never thought that inflation would wipe it out because there wasn't any inflation. They were quite right. When they sold their bonds 20 years later, the money was usually worth more. Inflation has crept into the system for lots of reasons. And the question is what to do about it. And the Germans have done the following about it. First of all, they've legitimated the role of labor. Labor unions sit on the boards of directors of big corporations, so they know there isn't some whammy going around the corner. Labor unions are assured very high unemployment benefits and don't have to get on their knees and beg for it. Labor unions are provided by the government with extensive government retraining operations when industries close down. So labor does not feel that it's up against the wall fighting for its life. And that means That labor is in the labor leaders are in a position to urge and work for non-inflationary wage contracts. In this country, where every union is up against the wall all the time, and where they're being zapped by both by government and by business, it's each for all and devil take the hindmost, and one union competes with the other to see who can get the best short-term gains for its membership. And the consequence is, or was until the recent recession, that many union contracts were signed, particularly in the 60s and 70s, that were very inflationary. They were getting more money for their employees, and their employees were earning in terms of higher productivity. So that's something that the Germans have got around by legitimizing labor. Meanwhile, labor and management won their own special agreements. Management has got the agreement from government to go and make intercompany arrangements of various sorts and to turn to government itself for financing assistance in ways that enables it to undertake a kind of high-tech, flexible organization to win shares in the world market. We have nothing like it in this country. When France, the consortium of countries that builds Airbus, let's call it France, builds the Airbus, they have the government to fall back on. Boeing doesn't have the government to fall back on. And finally, there's the government itself, which in those countries, it doesn't assume for a second, no modern government would, that it knows what branch of technology is going to lead the way tomorrow. But it stands there ready to underwrite whatever looks promising. And it is regarded by both labor and management as, so to speak, the best, most disinterested party to lay down a general monetary and fiscal approach. We have nothing like that tripartite understanding.
Well, you know, you're talking about the team of government, labor, and business. It seems like in this country, political leaders are either considered to be pro-business or pro-labor, but never pro-both.
Yes, that's right. And I would love to see a public leader who managed to convey the message that I'm talking about in whatever words would have the greatest resonance with the electorate. In some way, I think Franklin Roosevelt did that. He did talk, and it wasn't just rhetoric. It was deeply meant. He did talk about putting together the forces in the economy. They weren't quite so structured as they are today. I'm an old New Dealer, I guess, unregenerate New Dealer. I'd like to see that brought back to life.
Robert Heilbrunner, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Robert Heilbrunner is the co-author of The Debt and the Deficit, published by Norton.